This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for being with us on our Main Street across the state this time of day. And of course, it's the end of February. March is looming large, and it's still the dead of winter. But it's a nice time to sort of talk about something that warms the hearts of lots of people, and that is the spoken word. We're very big fans of it here on the radio. I have with me the director of radio for Prairie Public, Bill Thomas.
Hello.
Who has a very favorite project. Every year he checks out Poetry Out Loud, which was recently held in Bismarck.
Yes, they call me as a judge, and so I have to listen very attentively, but it's very rewarding. It's really wonderful. The first time they did this, you know, I thought, oh, I'm going to get a bunch of high school students reciting poetry. It's going to be da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, but oh, they do really, really great readings, and it's fun and moving to go to it.
Who takes part? Where are these high schools from? All over?
Well, this is the North Dakota State Contest, and in some higher population states, they do regionals and, you know, go down to the statewide one. But North Dakota isn't to that point of participation yet where they need to split it up. So it's high schools from anywhere in the state, and within the high school, they have to have a contest in the high school. And, you know, some high schools do it up as a bigger deal than others, but in some fashion, you have a contest in the school and you select a school champion, and then the school champion comes to the state contest and competes with the other school champions for who's going to be the statewide champion, and then the statewide one goes to the national finals in D.C.
All right, and we're going to hear from the statewide winner.
Yes.
But before we do that, how are the poems selected?
Well, this is done, it's coordinated by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, working with the National Endowment for the Arts, who works with the Poetry Foundation. And the Poetry Foundation is well endowed, and they support it financially. They're not the only supporters. The Arts Council here locally and the Humanities ND also support it. And they have a web page. And they have a very large selection, but a selection of poems, and the students have to choose from those. So they can go in and they can search by title or by author, or from talking to the students, what they mostly do is they say, give me a random poem, and they check it out. If they don't like it, it's on to the next one and next one till they find one that fits.
Well, let's get a sample of this. Emily Gilsrud?
Yes. She's from Wahpeton. And she picked a poem that I had not heard before that she really enjoyed, and I think you'll hear why when you hear her do it.
Megan Married Herself by Caroline Bird. She arrived at the country mansion in a silver limousine. She'd sent out invitations and everything. Her name written twice with ampersand in the middle, the calligraphy of coupling. She strode down the aisle to At Last by Etta James, faced the celebrant like a keen soldier reporting for duty. Her voice shaky, yet sure. I do. I do. You may now kiss the mirror, applause, confetti. Every single one of the 140 guests deemed the service unimprovable, especially the vows. So, from the heart. Her wedding gown was ivory, pointedly off-white. After all, we've shared a bed for 32 years, she quipped in her first speech. I'm hardly virginal, if you know what I mean. No one knew exactly what she meant. Not a soul questioned their devotion. You only had to look at them, hand cupped in hand, smiling out of the same eyes. You could sense their secret language, bone deep, blended blood. Toasts were frequent, tearful. One guest eyed his wife hovering harmlessly at the bar, and imagined what his life might have been if he'd responded years ago to that offer in his head. I'm the only one who will ever truly understand you. Marry me, Derek. I love you. Marry me. At the time, he hadn't taken his proposal seriously. He recharged his champagne flute, watched the newlywed cut her five-tiered cake, both hands on the knife. Is it too late for us to try? Derek whispered to no one. As the bride glided herself onto the dance floor, taking turns first to lead, then follow.
That was very entertaining.
Yes, no, she talks about it in the interview, how she was drawn to that one, and you can really hear how that would be an attractive one to recite.
And it's sophisticated. It's not what you really expect to hear from a high school student.
Yeah.
Well, you interviewed her.
Right. We had a chance to talk after she was declared the first place winner, and I talked with her and also with Christy Marr, who was the teacher who coached her. They met every day and read that poem, so they worked on it.
Yeah, I've been here four times, so every year in high school.
Uh-huh. So each time you come, you have to pick three poems. Mm-hmm. Did you pick ever, like, repeat a poem? Or?
Yeah, I actually repeated Let the Light Enter, which I did today, and then I've done Dear Reader a couple of times, too.
I'm curious about the process of choosing a poem to do. So I'll ask Emily first, and then her teacher about how that works, and what do you decide on when you're picking?
Yeah, I feel like I kind of take a while to choose, and I'm very indecisive. But so Megan Marion herself, I did today, and that one of our teachers at Wapton High School, Mrs. Woods, actually showed me, and I was like, this is so funny, and I just fell in love with it, and then we started working with it more and just adding more funny things to it, and it's so fun to do. And then for quite frankly, I was between four poems and I ended up narrowing it down to two eventually, and then I did it in front of the class, and right when after I said quite frankly, I was like, okay, this is the one. So definitely helps to say it out loud too, see how your voice fits with it. And then it's a lot of just click random poems and then just see what comes up.
Did you ever pick one that you thought you were going to do and then you decided, no, this one is just not working, I don't get it, or something like that?
I don't think so, really.
Uh-huh. Now, so when she's picking poems, do you advise her on her choices?
Well, early on, the students just all have to read a lot of poems to get a feel for what they like. But like Emily said, after, if she's indecisive or if she's trying to decide between several poems, we'll have her read it out loud so we can see what she feels comfortable with, where she, and then she'll know, she'll have a hunch what is part of her, what she wants to do. So.
Do you weigh things like, oh, how much I like this poem? Do you weigh things like, how hard is this going to be to convey to an audience and stuff like that?
Yeah, definitely both of those things. Mm-hmm.
So over the years, you've done several different poems. Do you have a favorite or a couple of favorites that you go like, wow, these were just, I'll always remember these. I'll be reciting them to my grandchildren.
I think Dear Reader has been my favorite. I've done that one a couple times, and it's the one I've probably performed the most, and the first poem I probably really fell in love with. So.
Mm-hmm. And that one is no longer on the Poetry Out Loud website,
yeah.
So she couldn't do that one for this year's performance, so she had to choose something else.
Yeah, and we should explain for our listeners that the way Poetry Out Loud works, it's not like the whole world of poetry to choose from. They narrow it. There's still a lot of poems, mm-hmm. but they narrow it down, and they have a website with some. And you have to pick a newer poem and an older poem, right? How does that work?
You have to pick one poem that is under 25 lines, and then another poem that's pre-20th century, and they can be the same poem.
Do you ever worry, like, the poem is too long or too short?
Yeah, that's definitely something we, like, look at when we're, like, looking for poems. Like, how hard is it? It's, like, we want to pick challenging poems, you know?
Do you ever get a chance to recite poetry outside of the Poetry Out Loud program?
I don't really.
Maybe just in English.
Yeah. Oh, in English class. we have presentations sometimes where we analyze poetry.
Let's see. You get to go to the national contest now. Mm-hmm. When is that coming up?
Is it on April 30th?
Is when we leave.
Mm-hmm. And where is that at?
Washington, D.C.
Okay. All right. Well, congratulations on coming for so many years and winning first place in your last year, finally, you know. It's like a dramatic story.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that, and thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
A very youthful-sounding Emily Gilsrud. And
yes.
She referred over and over to a favorite poem.
Yeah, yeah. And this, she liked doing this one. A few people have done it. It's called Dear Reader, and we do have a recording. The recording's a little rough, but it's still worth listening to from a previous year when she recited it.
Dear Reader, by Rita Mae Reese. You have forgotten it all. You have forgotten your name, where you lived, who you loved, why. I am simply your nurse. Terse and unlovely, I point to things and remind you what they are. Chair. Book. Daughter. Soup. And when we are alone, I tell you what lies in each direction. This way is death, and this way, after a longer walk, is death. And that way is death, but she won't see it until it is right in front of you. Once, after your niece had been to visit you, and I said something about how you must love her, or she must love you, or something useless like that. You gripped my forearm in your terrible, swift hand and said, "She is everything." You gave me a shake, everything to me. And then you fell back into the well. Deep in the well of everything, and I stand at the edge and call, chair, book, daughter, soup.
Very touching. And Emily Gilsrud, I think, has a real chance at the national competition with Megan Married Herself, Bill.
Yes, and so they're quite different, two very different poems. So Emily's from Wahpeton, and I think we'll have time to hear from our second place winner, who is from Bismarck High School. I should mention also Maria Kalb from St. Mary's Central in Bismarck, and Curtis Anderson from the Magic City campus in Minot, and Cassandra Rostved from Northwood High School were also winners this year.
So this is Christian Wolff?
Yeah.
And his poem, he's going to introduce himself, right?
Yeah, and this one's a little dramatic, but in a fun way.
Two Guitars by Victor Hernandez Cruz. Two guitars were left in a room all alone. They sat on different corners of the parlor. In this solitude, they started talking to each other. My strings are tight and full of tears. The man who plays me has no heart. I have seen it leave out of his mouth. I have seen it melt out of his eyes. It dives into the pores of the earth. When they squeeze me tight, I bring down the angels who live off the chorus, the trio singing loosened organs with melodious screwdrivers. Sentiment comes off the hinges. Because a song is a mountain put into words, and landscape is the feeling that enters something so big in the harmony, we are always in danger of blowing up with passion. The other guitar. In 1944, New York, when the trio Los Panchos started with Mexican and Puerto Rican birds, I am the one that one of them held tight like a woman. Their throats, gardenia gardens, an airport for dreams. I've been in theaters and cabarets. I played in an apartment on 102nd Street after the baptism, pregnant with women. The men flirted and were offered chicken soup. Echoes came out of hallways, as if from caves. Someone is opening the door now. The two guitars hushed, and there was a resonance in the air, like what is left by the last chord of a bolero.
All right. Well, that was very different, and we're reminded that poetry isn't just rhyming couplets.
Right, right. There's such a range. You know, sometimes there'll be something from the 16th century. This time there was some John Donne. There was Robert Frost, you know, to name some familiar authors. Emily Dickinson was in there. Hope is the Thing with Feathers. There was a great reading of that. And, yeah, they just such a variety and so well performed, such an anthology kind of performance of wonderful selections and preparations. Really, really fun to listen to it. And I'll be doing a special on it for our Prairie Public Presents later in March.
Well, being a judge has to be challenging.
Yeah, 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 it is. It's really, really difficult. But I do feel like with four judges and several sets of criteria that we look at, we manage to kind of average it out to a pretty good result.
And a reminder that poetry can be absolutely glorious and wonderful, especially when it's performed with such skill.
Yeah, and funny and heart-wrenching and depressing and exhilarating. The words in poetry, you know, are just, they're compressed. The poets really squeeze it down. And this is people trying to take what the poet did and then express it without, you know, without putting like too much of themselves in it. But they're really great.
Lots of essence there. Our congratulations to Emily Gilsrud, who will represent North Dakota at the national competition in Washington, D.C. Coming up on Main Street, Tom Reason goes to New Zealand with his wife to study a place like ours someplace else.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street on Prairie Public. Tom Easern is a regular on our show. He's a distinguished professor of history, the author of the recently published book Pacing Dakota, and the writer and voice of our Plainsfolk essays. Today, Tom's essay takes us to the other side of the world. Here's Learning from the Lindis.
About the time you hear this essay on our beloved Prairie Public, Suzanne and I will be jetting to New Zealand once again. We've scheduled our spring break in the Hawken Library at the University of Otago, the southernmost university in the world. From there, we will range into the field, the grassy basins of central Otago, for fieldwork in regional history. This itinerary puts into practice the advice I give my history students at NDSU. First, butts in the archives, and then boots on the ground. go get the history where it is. Where it is, in this case, is 8,000 miles away from home, which raises the question my late mother used to ask me as a prairie historian. Why do you have to go so far away to do your work? I gave her, more than once, an answer I knew would make sense to her as a prairie woman, a farm woman who relished the meetings of the Lutheran Women's Missionary League because they talked about fascinating places on distant continents, a woman who, once retired from the farm, traveled the world to see all those places she had heard and read about. I said, "Mom, because I can. I go to far reaches of the world in my work because I can." Now, you may be a more rigorous inquisitor than my mother, although I doubt it, but if you are, then you may point to the expense of trans-Pacific flights. You may note the difficult logistics of offshore research and the heavy demands on time made by such enterprises. So, my partner in crime and I have been thinking about these things and put together a paper entitled Learning from the Lindis. The Lindis is the region of central Otago, the history of which has occupied a slice of our time continually for the past two decades. It is a high basin of semi-arid grassland, historically a land of sheep stations and gold mines, now incorporating heady admixtures of viticulture and tourism. We love the Lindis, of course. We have our old friends and our watering holes there. But now, back to the accountability question, what's the deal with this distant and difficult, albeit pleasurable, research agenda? More than 30 years ago, as a young historian of the Great Plains, I realized that although my interests focus here, I needed to develop interests elsewhere, too. This had to do with establishing credibility. In the academy, if you only work on things in your own backyard, there are people who will always dismiss you as parochial for never having proven yourself in a larger arena. Well, nobody tries that sort of disparagement with me today because of the stature that comes with an international resume. I am more effective at home, just the way the world works. That may sound superficial, but here is a more concrete benefit. Becoming a first-rate historian, or any kind of scholar, requires imagination, being able to envision possibilities, what we in history call contingency. If your experience is only in one place, then your range of contingency is limited. You think that the way things worked out here is the way they must work out everywhere. Then you explore other scenarios, and you recognize the amazing possibilities of contingency. There are a lot of other benefits that precipitate when a prairie person ventures into unfamiliar places. I talk with my students about them whenever they will sit still for advice from an old coot. I'll talk some more with you about them when we come home from our current episode of Learning from the Lindis.
That's Tom Ezern, who is pacing New Zealand. Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media reports on the competition ethanol faces from electric cars. And we'll talk with the author and the designer of a new book about Sterion Bank founder Frank Larson. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Senate committee is considering a measure to expand the State Board of Higher Education from 8 members to 11 members. An earlier measure to create two separate boards of higher education, one for the research universities and one for the other campuses, died in the House.
I think it's important that we do something.
Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson.
And there's a lot of people that still think that the one board is still the best way to go, but they need help. They don't have enough board members, and so we would add three more.
Governor Burgum has said he would still like to push for the two-board plan. The original proposal from a governance task force was to go to three boards. It was amended in the House to a two-board idea before it was shot down on the House floor. The measure, which because it changes the state's constitution, would need to go to voters if the legislature approves it. It is now in the Senate Education Committee. The House has passed a resolution to forward to Congress in Washington, D.C. to urge a federal ban on abortions past 20 weeks of gestation. Republican Representative Bill Twight carried the resolution on the House floor. He said passing this resolution would send a powerful message to Congress.
Let's send a message to Washington that we do value life in North Dakota at all stages, and we, along with 20 other states, prohibit abortions from being performed 20 weeks post-fertilization, and ask our United States Congress to do the same.
The resolution was passed on a vote of 77 to 11. And a Grand Forks lawmaker wants any constitutional amendment to be approved by 60% of the state's voters. Right now, it can be approved by a simple majority.
The whole point of it is to strengthen the Constitution.
The Republican State Representative Steve Vetter says that's one reason he introduced the constitutional measure. He says another would be to educate the public.
And the public would realize, hey, there's a difference between constitutional and statutory laws. So whereas a lot of people don't really realize there's a difference, whereas I believe, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. The Constitution is a base or a foundation of all your laws, or it's a living document that needs to be changed all the time. I think it should be a base for the foundation of all the other laws, not a living document that needs to be consistently changed.
The measure is now pending in the House Judiciary Committee. If it passes the legislature, it would be on the ballot in 2020. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. You might be surprised to hear that each year, about 40% of the corn grown in the United States is processed into ethanol for gasoline. But the demand to reduce fossil fuel emissions has more drivers turning to electric cars. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer looks at how that may impact the Corn Belt.
So there's your first one. It's going to do it again.
Kevin Caldwell is demonstrating the hands-free feature of the all-electric Nissan Leaf.
So now it wants to completely stop because it thinks you're asleep at the wheel and you don't want to.
Aside from this nearly autonomous option, Caldwell says driving a Leaf is basically the same as driving a typical gasoline or gas-electric hybrid car, except you plug it in rather than pumping gas into it. Last year, 1 million electric cars were sold nationwide. As a manager at Hummel's Nissan in Des Moines, Caldwell says 25% to 30% of his Leaf customers are farmers. Like the others, they fall into two categories.
The customers that are more environmentally conscious and they want to lower their carbon footprint versus the customer that is simply wanting to not have to worry about gas prices.
Lee Tesdell is all in for reducing his carbon footprint. He owns a farm in Polk County, Iowa, where in 2013 he began installing solar panels.
And all the time I was thinking that I would like to also drive an electric car so that my solar electrical production would be part of the fuel for my electric car.
In December, he bought an all-electric Chevy Bolt for his commute. On the farm, he has a variety of conservation practices in place, raises sheep and grows alfalfa. He also has dozens of acres he rents out to a farmer who plants corn and soybeans. Ethanol has been a boon to corn farmers, but Tesdell says it's led to overproduction, which in turn has kept corn prices low the past several years.
I would like to see corn acres reduced by quite a lot in Iowa and more diversification.
And that could help farmers in two ways. Trevor Russell of the Friends of the Mississippi River Environmental Group says, first, diversifying would help farmers make the transition away from corn. And secondly, different crops like Kernza wheat or the oilseed camelina could help clean up polluted waterways and nurture depleted soils.
Let's not be left holding the ball on 40% of our corn crop that doesn't have a market and can't get sold anywhere. That would be an economic catastrophe for farmers and for rural communities.
But Russell says it's going to take the same types of government policies and incentives that expanded ethanol to establish viable markets for other crops. Farmers may not have much time to spare as the transition to electric cars is well underway.
Retooling our cropping systems to respond to that is going to take longer than the transition to electric vehicles will take. So we need to start yesterday.
But John Eichberger of the Washington, D.C.-based Fuels Institute says it's not time for the ethanol industry to panic yet.
We have people thinking, well, it's going to be electric or it's going to be liquid. It's probably going to be a combination for a long time because we're not going to transition 100%.
That's something Rand Faberg well knows. He commutes to his job as a welder in Ames, Iowa, in this 2012 Nissan Leaf that he bought used. He charges it in a barn on his farm where he raises hogs and cattle.
I have several trucks, cars, tractors. I still use a lot of gas, but electric is the way to go. And electric will overtake all the automobiles very shortly. I'm convinced of that.
And do you think that will be bad for your friends and neighbors who farm?
No. Overall, farmers can adapt. So I think it'll be good for everybody.
Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, Frank's Extra Mile.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we spent a second week in conversation with President Thomas Jefferson talking about the Constitution.
Jefferson was not at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, but he was, in a sense, the bibliographer of it, and he had extensive commentary about it once he received finished copies of it in the autumn of 1787 in Paris.
This week we talk about some of the compromises that were necessary for the delegates to make in order to ratify the Constitution.
Two principally, David. First, big states versus little states. That gave us equal representation in the Senate, proportional in the House. And secondly, of course, the original sin of American life, slavery. The can was kicked down the road by the Founding Fathers.
And we also acknowledge that in the end, we as citizens still have the power to change it. So join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Everyone's living on social media these days. And hey, so is Prairie Public.
Me love when friends come to visit.
Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Prairie Public.
They take pictures of themselves, and no surprise, they post them to Instagram.
You'll find television and radio content and behind-the-scenes views of Prairie Public via Facebook Live.
Well, we're live on Facebook. Time for another movie review with Matt Lee.
Interact by sharing your thoughts, opinions, and photos. Just not your cat photos. It's
talk to Prairie Public. We want to hear from you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Patrick McCloskey. He's the author of Frank's Extra Mile, and he joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Doug. Thank you for having us back.
And with you, Jerry Anderson. Jerry has collaborated with you before on a book, and Jerry is the photographer and book designer for Frank's Extra Mile. Thanks for joining us, Jerry.
Yeah, you're welcome, Doug.
Now, Patrick, this is the second book you and Jerry have collaborated on to tell the story of someone who's helped the University of Mary, where you mm-hmm. both work. Why did you choose Frank Larson?
Well, for a number of different reasons. He has been very generous with the university and provided a lot of leadership. I think more importantly, he has been a leader in North Dakota and has helped a lot of people. He's built a tremendous business with Starion Bank, which has been dedicated to helping communities across the state. And he's done it in a way that is quite inspiring.
And Jerry, you've laid this book out. It is a beautiful book, just like your other one.
Thank you.
The Open Secrets of Success, the Gary Farrelson story, another nice piece of work. Tell us about the process of designing something like this.
It's a lot like making sausage. You know, it tastes good when you get it out, but you don't want to watch it be made. We start out with an outline of where we're going to go with the story. We start assembling our assets. In this case, you know, the Larson family was very generous with us in sharing family archives and archives from Starion Bank. And then we collected a group of interviews with Frank, obviously, with employees and with customers of the bank. And when all those pieces are all assembled in one place, we start like Lego blocks. We start piecing it all together to match our outline.
Well, Frank Larson was born in Valley City 90 years ago last month, Patrick.
Right.
Give us a brief biography, because his life story is sort of North Dakota's in a way.
It really is. I mean, his father moved here from Minnesota and was involved in banking and farming even during the Great Depression, and helped a lot of farmers stay in their farms. Frank grew up in Valley City. And he went to high school there, then eventually went to the University of North Dakota, but he was also served 2 years in the Korean War. And he wanted to be a fighter pilot, but he ended up involved in intelligence training for pilots. When he came back to North Dakota, he went to UND Law School, graduated in 1963. But by then, he was also married and had several children. And he actually at that point wanted to be a farmer. And his father owned quite a bit of land, but his dad made sure that all the land was rented out so that Frank could not become a farmer. he was determined that Frank would do something with his law degree other than farming. So Frank worked with a gentleman in Valley City for about 5 years doing law and got peripherally involved in banking. I think he and his partner served on the board of a bank there. And Frank just was one of these guys who had big aspirations. And a lot of it was to do as much good as he could for people in the state he loved. Opportunity came along to get involved in banking, and kind of a light went on in Frank's head that this could match up those two aspirations in it, you know. And then so he started off and bought the bank in Oaks in 1969, National Bank of Oaks. He didn't have any money. So it's a really interesting story about how someone without any money and without any banking experience ends up starts buying banks, running them, and during a really rough period, because then again, this is the North Dakota story, drought, interest rates, the economy being really bad for farming, prices down, interest rates up, and somehow surviving through all of that and getting into the late 1980s where the real break in terms of real growth happened when he was able to buy the bank in Mandan and then in Bismarck, all of which became First Southwest Bank when they got a single charter. Eventually that became Starion, and today they have 12 branches in North Dakota and 3 in Wisconsin.
And $1.25 billion in assets.
Yes, starting off at $4.5 million in assets, all of which were owed. So they started off at that much in the hole, basically.
Now, there's a foreword by Senator John Hoeven, and he refers to Frank Larsen running for governor. When was that?
That was – okay, I have to – I'm going to – actually, I better
– check your book, huh?
Check my book. Well, because he ran for the governor in 1972, and then again he ran for the House in 1978. So 1972, he actually – it's interesting because he met with someone in the Republican Party to find out, you know, he was interested in going into public service. You know, what should I do? He's an unknown, no political experience. And the person he met said, "Well, why don't you run for governor?" Which Jerry would know at the time because you were here. Who was the governor at that point? The Democratic governor who everybody thought was a shoe-in.
In 1972?
Yeah.
That was pre-Center.
Art Link.
Oh, yeah. Sure, of course. Yeah, yeah. One of the most famous governors. Yep.
Well, Art Link won that election. But Bill Guy was supposedly a shoo-in. So nobody on the Republican side that was of stature in the party was thinking of running because they just figured it's no point. So Frank was advised to run. He started running, and his slogan was Frank Larsen, citizen for governor. And then Bill Guy decided he was going to run for Senate, which opened up the whole thing. And all the Republican, the main people in the party ran against Frank, ran. But interestingly, Frank ended up with almost 10% of the votes in the of delegates, which is interesting and tells a lot about Frank because he started with nothing and didn't know anybody and nobody knew him. So he did quite well considering.
He was pretty good at making friends, I take it.
Yeah.
Sure. Jerry, the book is a mixture of photographs and, again, it's beautifully laid out. I could ask you how you picked the type and all that kind of stuff and the spacing. It's a beautiful coffee table book. But you also have artwork in it.
Yeah, we needed to tell a broader story, I think, and tell it in a way that was a little bit open-ended. And the artwork served that purpose. Because the story of North Dakota, I think, visually is really difficult to capture in just photographs. It's about other things, too. And so we reached out to to find some art. A local artist, a friend of ours who's done some work with 360 Review and some of our other publications, including the Gary Thorildsen book, Tom Marple, came up with some, I think, some really wonderful illustrations that helped kind of broaden that feeling of the story.
Well, we should also mention that the book is dedicated with love to Jo Andrea Larson, who passed away in 2018, mm-hmm. with a quote from Franz Schubert, "Happy is the man who finds a true friend, and far happier is he who finds that true friend in his wife." That's pretty touching. Yeah. Where did the title Frank's Extra Mile come from?
That came from something that Monsignor Shea pointed out to me, and it just described Frank perfectly, because in his personal life and his professional life, and the main value he instilled in Starion Bank was always to go the extra mile for the customers. And it's also, in practical terms, how the bank survived those drought years and those high interest years in the 1980s, because there were a lot of bad loans on the books when Frank initially bought those banks. He was a visionary, and he didn't check as much as he probably should have into the state of the banks he was buying. So I ended up with a lot of bad loans. And then, well, it was really, what was interesting was initially for the first few years, what hurt him most was prosperity, because, you know, he was in Oaks and Ellendale and then in Bow Bells with these banks that were doing really, really well. And agriculture was doing well. But that meant that all of his customers were coming in wanting bigger and bigger loans, which meant that all the money he was making from the banks he had to put back into growing the bank to make interest, so he has to making loans. So he's having a great deal of trouble paying off the what he had borrowed to buy the banks in the first place.
Well, of course, the ag business can be boom or bust, and, mm-hmm. and so can the oil business. And there's a brief section in the book headlined "Passing on Petroleum,"
right?
And that I think suggests Starion's business philosophy. They don't want to get into things they don't know about, I take it.
Precisely. They started off in agriculture. They know agriculture quite well. Eventually, they got into commercial and home mortgages and all that sort of thing. But they're always drew the line on what they know and don't know. And oil isn't something they understood. And I know. And Craig told me at one point that he'd asked someone at another bank, a friend of his who was running another bank, how they were doing with the oil business, and it turned out that bank had to call in experts from Texas and Oklahoma. You know, so clearly they didn't have the expertise at home, and it's Craig took that as a lesson that hey. If it's really complicated, it's not our expertise, it's another boom and bust cycle business, and we're just staying away, you know.
Is there a story behind the name Starion?
Oh, yeah, actually there is. It's an aspirational name. It has no particular meaning in the language, but the word star and the word achievement and the feeling of achievement, reaching for a star, setting a star on the horizon, guiding by a star – all those things played into that name. Obviously they wanted a blanket name that wasn't First Southwest Bank, which wasn't even literally descriptive anymore. So they reached out and essentially, like Frank did, created something new.
Jerry Anderson is the photographer and book designer. Patrick McCloskey, the author of Frank's Extra Mile. This is published by University of Mary Press. And you both also collaborate on 360 Review magazine, which is a very beautiful publication as well. Jerry, you referred to teaching at UMary. Can you describe the class you teach?
I teach a class in photography and also teach a class in graphic design.
So you're interested in the way things look, the way things are laid out, and obviously that's expressed in the book that we're talking about today. What kind of – do you have a philosophy you share with your students about how to do this well?
I think I always try to start off – and I think we did a good job in this book. I always try to start off with the idea that first and foremost, a book or a magazine or any publication you're designing is a tool for communication. And I use the metaphor of a chair. You could build a beautiful chair that had, you know, fantastic colors and wonderful upholstery and incredible materials. But if it didn't feel good to sit in, then functionally it's not a very good chair. So if you're designing a book, you have to get your information across, and you have to get it across in a way that's going to facilitate what you're talking about. And you start from the premise that it has to be a good book first, and then you add the beauty and the other things as layers on top of that. But at its basement level, if it doesn't communicate, it isn't a good book.
And this book, as I mentioned, is a good-looking book. It's also a well-made book. Where do you have this printed?
We've been using a publishing company out of Altona, Manitoba, up north of you there, just barely over the Canadian border. They specialize. They're one of the largest publishers in Canada, or one of the largest book printers in Canada. And geography plays a part in that. And also, they've just been a very, very good vendor for us.
Well, people who like books and like the feel of them will like the feel of this one. As I mentioned, Patrick, you wrote a book about Gary Tharaldson, who mm-hmm. also gave significant support to you, Mary. And as a matter of fact, this book was launched at a party in the Gary Tharaldson School of Business's Butler Auditorium. So correct. Larson, Tharaldson, and Butler are philanthropists who have invested in the U Mary mission. Mm-hmm. That's important, isn't it?
Well, it is important to invest in our mission, and it goes very much with their values personally and their company values of being servant leaders throughout North Dakota. You know, they're both gentlemen, and I mean, you'd ask me about the title, and the title is Frank's Extra Mile, A Gentleman's Story, both Gary and Frank are gentlemen, which is kind of rare these days in a sense. You don't see it on the national in the national media all that much, that they really are gentle people who are very effective, full of lots of energy and vision, and get a lot done, but they don't do it by taking advantage of other people. They do it by serving other people.
And again, Frank Larson is 90 years old mm-hmm. and has created something remarkable, a very large and successful business, which I suspect he's somewhat retired from.
Well, he's still peripherally involved, but he's still the CEO of the bank corporation that owns Starion. He's still I came up with the title. He's the chief visionary officer still, and I think that's very true. I mean, he's loved by everyone throughout the organization.
I like that title, the CVO.
Huh? Yeah, it's basically what he is these days. And I also wanted to point out that, you know, both Frank Larson and Gary Tharaldson are Lutherans who support a Catholic university because they see that what we're doing at UMary is so beneficial to the entire state.
That's ecumenical of them. The book is Frank's Extra Mile, A Gentleman's Story. It was written by Patrick McCloskey, and it was laid out and designed by Jerry Anderson. Both of you are with the University of Mary, and this is published by the University of Mary Press. Where is it available?
Well, you can buy it through the University of Mary bookstore, obviously. We'd be happy to send you a copy. You can get it on Amazon, like every other book on the planet right now.
Yeah.
And it's available now.
All right. Well, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Doug.
Patrick McCloskey and Jerry Anderson. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question why is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority and I'm not very good with limits. And so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple. And we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life, every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 27th. The weather was fine as the men of the Corps of Discovery worked on their pirogue boats for several days at Fort Mandan on the Missouri River during their winter with the Mandans and Hidatsas. Meriwether Lewis, William Clark, and their men would begin the next leg of the trip with the coming of spring and were busy with preparations. Their winter in what is now North Dakota was their longest stay along their trail. It was a brutal winter. Many men and villagers experienced frostbite. A teenage boy sustained frostbite so bad that the men of the expedition had to amputate his toes. He went home about a month later in a sleigh. Winter at Fort Mandan did have its positive moments. The men celebrated the New Year with music and dancing with their neighbors and the firing of 2 cannon shots. They also watched a total lunar eclipse in early January. The men planned to send their expedition's keelboat home to Missouri in the spring, switching to the smaller, canoe-like pirogues they were busily building. Members of the party also labored at making charcoal and battle axes that they could trade for corn. The axes proved popular. When Lewis and Clark were returning east, they witnessed the axes being used as gambling stakes by the Nez Perce in the region we now know as northern Idaho. The men eventually left their winter camp on April 7th. It would be another 16 months before they returned on their way back to St. Louis. In some ways, their winter at Fort Mandan was a highlight of the expedition. It was when Pomp was born to Sacagawea and Toussaint Charbonneau, and it was arguably more enjoyable than their boring winter in 1806 at Fort Clatsop in Oregon, where they only had elk meat and water and dealt with endless rainy weather. But is that worse than 45 below? Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat.
In his remarks on Capitol Hill, Michael Cohen made serious allegations against President Trump. How will Congress respond to Cohen's testimony? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll feature a cutting edge podcast with host Tom Gerhart and Lene Lease as they discuss the Personalized Learning Academy at the new Rockford Cheyenne Schools. Matt Olin will review If Beale Street Could Talk and comment on the Academy Awards. Sue Balcom will offer some ideas for winter reading about food. And we'll share our What's Happening calendar of things to do. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.